Hello, this is Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, along with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist, welcoming you to the Health and Happiness Show on 95.9 FM, KGVM, or KGVM.org. Here we discuss all topics related to health, both mental and physical. We are here under the umbrella of the Montana Psychological Association's Public Education Committee. We appreciate their support. And now, Suzanne will introduce our topic.
In Montana, 51 out of 56 counties are designated as health professional shortage areas. And a large percentage of our current doctors are nearing their retirement age, more especially in rural and frontier areas. This is highly concerning, and that is especially why we're so grateful to have with us today Dr. Christina Myers, a practicing physician at Bozeman's Community Health Partners, and her assistant, Kyle Benson, an aspiring medical student. Welcome. First of all, Kyle, we'd like to ask, what has inspired you to want to become a doctor? And by the way, we're so thrilled that you are.
Thank you. For myself, I would say that starts back when I was pretty young. My father, he has always had a career in healthcare. He worked as a paramedic for a time. He worked in a hospital lab for a time, and currently he's working as a technician who fixes up MRI machines for Siemens. And I would say there was just this one specific time where my family and I, we were taking a drive going from my house to our grandparents' house for a dinner, and there was this terrible blizzard. And I remember there was this bad, really bad car accident. And my father, he just pulled off on the side of the road because he had the knowledge, had the expertise to help out. So he got out of his vehicle and he ran over and he helped out where he could. And I think since then, I just thought this is the kind of profession that I wanted to get to. I wanted to help people in a way that most people cannot. And I figured if I'm willing to put in the time and the effort and I have the interest, then I can do it.
And that is how I think most all of us feel that most doctors went into the field, because of their great desire to be that kind of a helper for humanity. And we thank you for that, Kyle. And Dr. Myers, was that your motivation? What were all of your motivations to join the medical community?
I have not really a similar story, but something that goes back to my early childhood. I'm the youngest of three kids, and my brother, who's the oldest, had gotten a really terrible infection in his foot. And it was really my experience in him going to the hospital and being treated that our pediatrician saved his life. And from that moment on, I was really curious about medicine. We didn't have anyone in my family. I come from a family of educators, so I didn't have anybody in the healthcare field, but just happened to be someone who was drawn to science and always really interested in learning. And you definitely have to be willing to put in the work, because it's not a short path to get there, but very fulfilling to be able to provide care for people and hopefully save some lives.
Well, I must disclose at this point, for pure transparency, that Dr. Christina Myers is our family physician as well. And we've received golden medical treatment, and we really feel that we need more medical professionals like Kyle and Christina. And Kyle, tell us a little bit about the process, because this show is one time we'd really like to reach out to anyone considering becoming a doctor, nurse, entering the medical field. How difficult is it to apply for medical school? And then Christina, what is that wonderful procedure once you're accepted into medical school?
Yeah, I would say difficult, yes, in the sense that there's a lot of things that you want to be able to do in order to get to that point where you can get into medical school. You know, they look at extracurriculars such as volunteer hours. They look at leadership hours. They look at clinical hours that you've had experience with, internships, shadowing experiences, research experience. And these are all things that I remember when I first had decided that I was going to pursue a career in medicine that I wasn't even sure about. I didn't even know if I'd be able to have the time to do it. I was actually pursuing a degree in health administration at first before I switched gears and started going towards becoming a medical doctor. But it's just about really just taking the time that you are putting in the time to get all those kinds of things done and really showing yourself as a holistic applicant to medical school that can help them understand that you're willing to put in that effort that they're expecting to see in their students.
So I know that I've helped many aspiring med students with internships of various kinds. So you would recommend to young people out there who were wanting to be admitted to medical school to volunteer at a clinic, a hospital, a doctor's office, to get any kind of good experience and internship type work that they can before they apply for medical school to show they've got a really lively interest. Would I have stated that correctly, Kyle?
Absolutely. And then I would even add, volunteer in other places that interest you as well. I spent a good chunk of my time last year volunteering at a rock climbing gym as part of my volunteer service, because that's something that I love to do. Mm-hmm. And that's what medical schools look at, is what other kinds of things they're doing outside of medicine as well.
Oh, good point. Good point.
And I think also, and I think everybody probably understands it, but you have to keep your academic record pretty high as well, don't you?
Yes, that is very true.
I will say we had one friend who retired from the military, and he retired at a very young age, maybe 51 or so, full career in the military, and applied to medical school and was accepted. He'd always wanted to be a physician, and he said, I'll be able to practice another 15 or 20 years, and I want to be a general practitioner who helps every person who I can. So just an alert out there, it's not only young people that might consider a medical career.
Yes, I agree with that as well.
Dr. Myers, what was your trajectory since you'd already thought about the medical field? How difficult was becoming a doctor?
Certainly the application process, you know, can be arduous. I did not get in on my first try and tried again, and was fortunate the second go around that I did. So sometimes it takes a little persistence in addition to all of that experience that you've acquired. I definitely felt like I was probably interested in primary care, and there are, you know, some medical schools that are more focused on training people for primary care, although you get that general education anywhere in medical school. But I attended Oregon Health and Sciences University, and they really are trying to adjust the primary care shortage that we have in the country and have a rural track, much like the WAMI program that is educating a lot of our aspiring Montana physicians get to come back to Montana and do some of their education here in that rural track. And then medical school for most people is a 4-year endeavor. unless you're also getting your master's of public health or in an MD, PhD program, which would certainly extend that education longer. And then there's a process afterwards where you match with your residency, which is a very exciting day where you find out what residency program you get to go to after, again, applying to places that you're interested in going in your chosen profession. And I was fortunate also to get my first choice, which made it so that I didn't have to leave the home that I had made in Portland just yet, and did my residency in Hillsborough, which is a suburb south of Portland. Family medicine residency is 3 years, as are many of the other primary care endeavors, a three-year program. Specialty physicians often have a much longer residency program, and residency is like on-the-job training. You are getting paid a very small amount for the high number of hours that you're working, but you're working with supervising physicians and really learning how to practice medicine after you've gotten your education and a lot of exposure to all the different facets of medicine. Family medicine, most people work in an outpatient clinic like I do, but you also have to spend a lot of time working in the hospital and in the intensive care to just understand the medicine and get all that exposure so that hopefully you can retain that knowledge and really identify severe disease. And then in rural areas, there are a lot of primary care providers who do both. You know, they might rotate into their local hospital's emergency room or take care of people on the inpatient side as well as in their outpatient clinics. So it can be quite diverse what your career ends up looking like after you get through your residency training. And then I was really drawn to federally qualified health centers as what I felt like is the best way to deliver primary care. And that has made up the majority of my career. After I finished my residency in Oregon, my first job was with the Virginia Garcia Memorial Health Center, which is a federally qualified health center also in Hillsborough, Oregon, that provides care mostly to migrant farm workers that travel up and down the West Coast following fruit harvest and picking up fruits and vegetables that fill our grocery stores and our tables. I'm fortunate to speak Spanish, and so that was a big draw for me and for the clinic who hired me to be able to provide care in both English and Spanish for those patients. And then after starting a family and having worked there for a few years, we decided smaller community was what we wanted to raise our family in, and that's what brought us to Bozeman, Montana. Again, I wanted to stay at a federally qualified health center because it is an excellent care delivery system. To become a federally qualified health center, like what used to be called Community Health Partners and is now One Health, we're struggling a lot to actually change our name. You're mandated by the federal government to provide medical, behavioral, and dental care to your patients. You have to provide care to anyone regardless of their ability to pay. We accept all forms of insurance, but if people are uninsured or their insurance also comes with high copays, you can apply for a sliding fee scale so that you can pay a rate that is discounted based on what your income is and federal poverty guidelines. It really opens the doors to providing care to all of your community and providing holistic care, taking care of mind, body, and, as we know, so important, dental health.
We so appreciate the work your clinic is doing. We just like to point out that we came there with full insurance, medical coverage, and we came because of the high quality of the physicians. And we feel like everybody should consider going to Community Health Partners, and that also helps support those who might have difficulty with payment or with language or the various things that might inhibit people from medical care, which this clinic is actively trying to help. So, Kyle, I hear that one should maybe consider applying to 10 different medical schools, applying more than once, and being very diligent about applications. And so we appreciate your input on that, and we'd sure love to have more people applying themselves this direction in Montana. As we said, we're running out of doctors if we don't make some inroads on this. And so thank you so much for going over that particular need. And we also had another topic that we wanted to discuss, and that is that there have been great changes in the medical world as we hear about it in the United States of America recently. In fact, Robert Kennedy Jr., the health secretary and a longtime vaccine critic, announced in a statement last Tuesday that $500 million worth of vaccine development projects, which use mRNA technology, will all be halted. The projects, 22 of them, are being led by some of the nation's leading pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer and Moderna to prevent flu, COVID-19, and H5N1 infections. These mRNA vaccines were credited with slowing the 2020 coronavirus pandemic. Mr. Kennedy said in the Tuesday statement that he wants the health department to move away from mRNA vaccines, calling on the department to start investing in better solutions, although he provided no details on what those technologies might be. So therefore, the headline from AP, August 5, 2025, 6:54 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, RFK Jr. pulled funding for vaccines being developed to fight respiratory viruses. And it was stated that the Department of Health and Human Services under Kennedy will cancel contracts and pull funding for some vaccines that are being developed to fight respiratory viruses. I just wonder if you could tell us, do you consider this to be an alarming change? Should we be concerned, Dr. Myers and Kyle?
I would say yes. Without reservation, we should be concerned. I think the most concerning part of this is that it feels like this is a real unilateral decision on the part of the Secretary of Health and Human Services, whereas most public health decisions are more of a consensus and a committee. We've heard in previous news reports about him really dismantling the vaccine safety committees and changing recommendations on administration of vaccine in this real sort of one person making a decision that affects millions of people. And that piece, I feel, is terrifying.
Let me just mention or ask, is Robert Kennedy a doctor, or does he have any medical background to be determining these matters?
I do not believe that he's a doctor, but I don't know what his educational background is.
I can answer that. No, he isn't.
Yeah. He also stopped people in Texas from using the measles vaccine. So As of August 5th, again, 2025, there are now 1,356 cases of measles reported in 41 jurisdictions, the highest number in 33 years. RFK expressed skepticism of vaccines, and he promoted the use of vitamin A, an unproven treatment to prevent disease.
I am pleased to see that on the CDC's website, it still does say that vaccine for measles is the best way to prevent measles infection. I was a little worried that that information would be changed after his recommendation, which really only discussed treatment once you've been infected, whereas we've seen that prevention is much more effective than, and we don't really have any treatments other than supportive care once somebody is infected with the measles. And in looking at the same data, 96%, I believe, of people who have contracted measles are either unvaccinated or their vaccine status is unknown. I guess it was 92%. And then 4% of those people have only had one dose of the measles vaccine, and 4%, unfortunately, received the full series, but still got sick. But the efficacy of the measles vaccine, if you get the appropriate series, is really high. And that is the best way to prevent getting measles, which is the most effective infectious disease that we have. It is spread very easily, which is what makes it so dangerous, because it can cause very severe disease.
Well, Dr. Myers, the vaccinations cause autism, don't they?
They do not. Okay. That's been 100% disputed.
I know, and I remember talking to a young mother who was saying after an exercise class that she wasn't going to have her kids vaccinated, and she understood. She'd read up that polio was just like a little flu problem, and that it would not hurt anybody, and then you would be immune. And I had to explain to her that I was a child before they had a polio vaccine, and that everything was shut down where I was. The movies, markets, everywhere. People were afraid to go out because so many people were dying, were in iron lungs, were being crippled. The president of the United States, Roosevelt, got this disease and had a severe limp and was disabled for the rest of his life. So I guess I've been there before we had the vaccines, and I remember lining up so gratefully because now we could go back out again. We could go to the movies on Saturday and we would be safe. There's something so amazing about the change that that vaccine made when I was a child.
And I think you bring up two really important points. Many of the parents who really just want to do the best for their children are coming at this not knowing what these diseases can do, not seeing the ramifications of these vaccine-preventable diseases, because vaccines are effective. And so they don't know what polio can do. They haven't seen measles, encephalitis. They don't know people who have died from these diseases. And so we're coming at it from a place of privilege that comes from the efficacy of these vaccines really decreasing the numbers of these vaccine-preventable illnesses. I mean, the United States said that measles was eradicated 25 years ago, and it's coming back because of both international travel, and measles is still highly prevalent worldwide, and it is spreading because of decreasing herd immunity as fewer people are getting immunized. Another really challenging point is that we live in an age of information overwhelm, and there is a lot of misinformation in there about the safety of vaccines and whether you should or should not take them. And I think another really challenging and scary piece of the position that RFK Jr. is in is that he is in this role of authority, yet he is an anti-vax proponent over his entire career. And so coming from this position of authority, people feel like they should be able to trust and believe him, but he sows seeds of misinformation and, references data that is old and out of date and has been disproven, but does it from this position of authority where people believe it.
Unfortunately, yes. And in fact, the Associated Press reported that 14 million children did not receive vaccines in 2024 after all of the political rhetoric about vaccines.
Yes. And we saw during the COVID pandemic that people who were vaccinated died less.
Oh, yeah.
And unfortunately, yeah. Tens of thousands of people who chose not to get vaccinated ended up having severe disease, hospitalization, and death at far higher rates than there were complications from the vaccine.
And, you know, it seems that we would have learned that politics should not be involved in medical care. And this, to me, when the CDC noted post-COVID that four times as many Republicans died as Democrats, it should alert us to the fact that politics really has no place in our medical care.
Absolutely. And that's another real challenge with, you know, dismantling what has been the vaccine council, you know, having a group of physicians reviewing data and looking at safety and making decisions, you know, to this sort of unilateral one person taking that role, it really, I think, should incite a lot of fear in people about what the future holds as far as recommendations and where that information is coming from.
Maybe fear and fury. So,
yeah, absolutely.
And
fury
fact,
as well.
Yes. Mr. Mike Osterholm, a University of Minnesota expert on infectious diseases and pandemic preparations. And I quote, "I don't think I've seen a more dangerous decision in public health in my 50 years in the business." And he talked about all the many advantages of mRNA technology.
Yeah. And, you know, to think about just halting more than a decade of research when we already saw how effective implementation of the COVID vaccine was in the face of a pandemic. Nobody feels like pandemics are going to be decreasing in frequency with climate change and global travel and how our world is evolving. It's not a matter of if, but when the next pandemic is coming.
And it's not just medical experts who recognize this, but the Nobel Prize in Medicine went to the scientists whose work on mRNA led to COVID vaccines. So we have accolades around the world for those who had the heart when all of us were very fearful of this disease to go ahead and work with it and develop a vaccine. So we really need to thank them and to keep up the good work.
Suzanne, wasn't there a developing bit of research about older people who'd had their vaccinations, how it was related?
Yes. There is one side effect. The thing that a lot of people I've read about who don't get the vaccinations are those who are against the vaccinations, they say there are side effects that are very bad. And they go on and on about the side effects, which again, have not shown to be the case. very rare side effects. However, there's one side effect that was recently found this last year. Older patients taking the vaccine, their side effect was less development of Alzheimer's disease. Have you seen that study, Dr. Myers?
I did not see that. That's beautiful. Amazing.
I'll send you a copy. So now we have true scientific knowledge of one of the side effects of taking the vaccine.
I'll take that side effect.
Yes.
But we've long heard that from people, you know, the concern that the vaccine is making them sick. If, you know, 12 to 24 hours after getting your vaccine, you maybe feel unwell. You might even have a low-grade fever. You might have some chills or a headache or kind of feel sick. And that's actually a good thing. That is evidence that your immune system is responding to the vaccine and generating antibodies. When you are actually sick with an illness and you mount a fever, that is your immune system working to kill off whatever that pathogen is. And so these low-grade symptoms of illness that we may have after receiving any vaccine is actually a good thing. It's your body's immune system working. You might not feel great, but you should sort of be like, oh, good, this vaccine is working. It's triggering my immune system. It's helping me create the antibodies that I need to fight off disease when I'm exposed to it.
Cal, does any of this discourage you?
In terms of discouragement, it definitely makes me very worried about how things are going to be looking when I get to the point where I'm going to be helping out in these kinds of things, which is several years down the road, of course. But at the same time, it's something that I want to know about. I want to be prepared for it, so I can definitely be a voice and help out where I can.
You stick in there, Kyle. We're going to need you. And, you know, one of the sadder things to me about Robert Kennedy dismissing the mRNA vaccines is that I read several articles about wonderful other uses they were hoping for those. One article said, after battling COVID, can mRNA vaccines fight cancer? So their studies were into this vaccine's ability to fight some cancers and also HIV and autoimmune disorders in another article were being approached with the thought of using the mRNA vaccines in a different manner, but using them nonetheless. So I'm really hoping that the fact that Mr. Kennedy has seen fit to take down vaccine prevention using mRNA is not going to affect other areas of research that were very promising. Have you read about any of those, Dr. Myers?
I have seen, you know, that this is also in the works. And I feel like when I was looking at this, it seems unclear, you know, if that's included in the 22 programs that are being shut down as this money is being taken away, or if cancer research will continue, even though it is with the same technology. It wasn't clear to me as I was looking into that.
That's a good question.
You know, concern on all fronts about the future of scientific research as this administration is also attacking our universities, which have long been at the forefront of scientific research, you know, leading the whole globe in learning and understanding new technologies on every front. I think what's happening in the Department of Education is also quite worrisome for our future as a country.
With the challenge to funds for Medicaid, Medicare especially, how is that going to impact what your local clinic here in Bozeman?
I think all community health centers probably across the country are really concerned about what will happen with the one big, beautiful bill. It's been in the news over and over again that Donald Trump ran on promises that he would not make cuts to these vital programs. But in passing this bill, there was definitely language that talks about cuts to Medicaid. And I've heard some legislators say, no, it's just, certain people without legal status wouldn't be allowed to get Medicaid. Well, they already are not allowed to get Medicaid, at least in Montana. And to talk about work requirements, most people who are able to are working, who receive Medicaid. They're working for employers with health insurance, and they're among the working poor, and they need health insurance to better their lives and to keep themselves and their families happy. And unfortunately, what we're seeing in a lot of these programs to verify your eligibility is that people get caught up in a web of bureaucracy and broken systems, and they lose their insurance because of a change in address or delays in paperwork processing, and none of that is fair to the American people who are really just trying to work hard and keep themselves and their families healthy. I think we should make it easier rather than harder for people to access health care.
I know our son-in-law, an ER physician, is doing more work with AI and IT now with an app, but he was an ER physician. And as I understood it, as money for healthcare goes down in the general communities, the ER rooms are filled up more and more with people who have to come in there after they get so sick they can't do anything else. Is that pretty accurate?
It is. If people had, and this also speaks to the healthcare provider shortage, if people had access to primary care and could get consistent care to both address, prevention of cancer as well as monitoring for chronic disease and treatment of chronic disease, emergency rooms could be reserved for critical emergencies. But when people don't have access to primary care, they end up using the emergency room for primary care problems. And then that can bottleneck the emergency room so that there isn't enough room for emergencies to go in there. We saw a big shift with Medicaid expansion in Montana a decade ago, where there was a big influx of patients who hadn't had regular care for a really long time because they'd been uninsured. And it's taken us a while to get a lot of our patients sort of under good control for the chronic diseases. And I worry about people losing their insurance again and having another lapse in that excellent care.
One point that our son-in-law made is that when those people who don't have insurance, but they get really sick and they finally end up having to go to the ER, it costs the system so much more to treat them in that setting. And it really makes it almost insanely more expensive than it would have been had they been able to just go to the doctor's office and get an antibiotic or whatever it was they needed.
Absolutely.
What about health care for Native Americans? Is it, I know there's always something in the news here in Montana about reservations and where the care is not really being given very well or does not access. Do you know much about that?
I know less than I'd like to about that. I mean, the Indian Health Service is designed to provide care for Native Americans and be accessible, but we know that many reservations are very rural and don't have great roads and transportation, and so it might be really challenging to get to the Indian Health Service. from where it is that you live. Over my career, I've had Native Americans who maybe are coming to Bozeman to attend MSU, and they will seek medical care here while they're living here, and then they'll go back to the Indian Health Service care when they are home, you know, maybe for the summer or holidays to reservations. I know the Indian Health Service really tries hard to provide care in a very similar way to federally qualified health centers, where they're, you know, I think costs are mostly zero, and you can get medications off of a formulary to manage your chronic disease. But I think the real challenge is access and having the clinic staffed appropriately. I think they struggle a lot to find providers to work in those clinics.
Again, that was our opening point, that one out of four people wasn't getting the care he or she needed because of the rural areas being less adaptable to medical care.
And the question I have, maybe it's a little early in the program to ask, but what vaccines should we be getting or prepared to get for the upcoming seasons?
Well, as we are, I don't really want to say it, approaching fall, I don't like the end of the summer, we start to think about flu season. And that seasonal vaccine really should be updated once a year, trying to address the known variations in the flu virus and how it mutates year to year. And really, there is a new updated COVID vaccine that for the last 2 years we've been sort of recommending in the fall you get both your flu and COVID vaccine. And I would have assumed prior to 2 days ago, maybe this will change, but that was going to be kind of our new norm, that you get your flu and COVID vaccine every fall. Many people haven't received a COVID booster in a few years and definitely would be eligible to get that booster. We are expecting a pretty significant COVID illness this year, because last year ended up being smaller numbers and not a severe disease, and people are a little bit behind and they're updating their immunizations, and so it might be a more severe COVID season this year. And then otherwise, immunizations are really kind of age based, and so we've got great tables that we can follow looking at your age and what those recommendations are. As the measles cases were increasing, which was something that changed in our electronic health records, remind providers to talk to patients about having their MMR vaccine. People who were born between, I'm going to get these numbers wrong, I wish I had them in front of me, I think it's 1958 and 1963, may have just received one MMR vaccine or an MMR vaccine that's been found to be less efficacious. And so the age group is recommended to get a booster or even get the two-shot series. People born before that are considered immune because of exposure that would have happened when outbreaks were rampant. And then people born after that window, you know, should receive the usual vaccine series for MMR, which typically is done the first shot after your first birthday, and another shot before you start kindergarten, so after the age of 4, and really given around age 5. Everyone should get their tetanus booster every 10 years, and for the last many years, it's been recommended that you not only get your tetanus booster, but you get the Tdap, tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis. In this region, we have seen outbreaks of pertussis, and so getting that booster in addition to your 10-year tetanus booster is recommended for everybody to increase your immunity to pertussis, which is the whooping cough or 100-day cough. Folks over the age of 50 can get the shingles vaccine, and then our newest vaccine, the RSV vaccine, has different recommendations depending on whether you're pregnant or based on age, and then has been shown to decrease hospitalizations and deaths in the very young and very old to have that vaccine updated.
Thank you. I hope everyone took note of that, and we can go and get those shots at Community Health Partners or the health department, or your own family physician. So there's all of us, each of us could get vaccinated.
You can get them at most of the pharmacies, I believe.
Yeah. It's really nice to have that increased accessibility for people to get their immunizations.
That's right. Even Costco gives some of these. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one more quick question. Dr. Paul Offit, a vaccine expert at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, was concerned about a possible bird flu pandemic. Have you had any reports of bird flu?
Fortunately, we have not seen any here, but I do think that that is on everybody's mind. And I think also was something that was being researched with mRNA vaccines to potentially include that.
Yes.
Cover it.
Mm-hmm. So now that research is gone by the wayside. So that's a shame. Yeah. Well, we here really want to encourage everyone in the audience to consider vaccinating your children and to consider getting vaccinations and encourage those around you. And Dr. Myers, could you just give us the address or how people could find Community Health Partners?
Community Health Partners has clinics in Bozeman, Belgrade, and Livingston. The Bozeman clinic, where I and Kyle are homed, moved a few years ago from the Mendenhall office to a new space at 1695 Shockey Lane, and that was a big upgrade in our space and capacity, where dental and medical and behavioral health are now all under the same roof, and we were able to expand our clinical pharmacy. The pharmacy is open to anyone in the community, and for our patients who receive our sliding scale discount, they can also use that discount in the pharmacy. So you can get your vaccines there too. Our Belgrade clinic is right on Main Street in Belgrade, and they have medical and behavioral health services in their office. Belgrade also offers behavioral health services and what is called the Panther Clinic in the Belgrade Middle School, which is an excellent service for the community as well. And then the Livingston Clinic is right on Lewis and Main Streets in Livingston. They do have a dental clinic, medical, behavioral health, and their pharmacy just got an upgrade after the roof leaked. It sort of forced a renovation and expansion of their pharmacy, and I believe they're moving into that new space tomorrow. So they've been working out of a temporary pharmacy for several months, and then we're able to renovate and expand. So that'll be really nice for that community as well.
Excellent, excellent.
I wanted to ask Kyle something. Did you say you were going into primary care, or did you want to specialize?
As of right now, I have an interest in endocrinology. However, I took this job as a medical assistant because I wanted to see what primary care would be like. And I could see myself going into primary care as well now. I thoroughly enjoyed my time working at this clinic.
I'd like to say that Kyle shot me a couple of weeks ago And he did an excellent job. I didn't feel a thing. You're already great at this, Kyle.
Thank you.
Well, although the vaccine panel, all the members were ousted just recently, I guess for political reasons, the entire 17-person vaccine advisory committee was ousted. I think we should all take seriously that vaccinations are an important part of safe and healthy life. And I would just like to again express great faith in those many vaccinations that have kept me safe my entire life. And I just hope that we can get back to creating new vaccines for all the other threats that might be coming our way. And we will go ahead and talk about that some more, but I also wanted to just mention another political thing. We hear a lot about removing immigrants from the United States, and I want to point out that one in four of our doctors are immigrants. They're foreign-born. Their numbers are even larger because they are most often found in underserved areas with low income and in the more rural areas. So it is my feeling, my statement here, that we should really protect our medical consultants and physicians and nurses who might be from somewhere else, but they're here serving us. And about, in a recent survey, 8 in 10 Americans say that immigration is a good thing. So what we know is that people support having people of value from anywhere in the world to come and help us. And I just wanted to mention again that medicine is all about helping people and should never be about politics.
Well said.
Just a side question. Is the unfortunate thing that any of your patients or clients have been removed because they were immigrants?
Fortunately, that has not happened. We've always considered a medical clinic and hospitals to be a safe space and really protected from that sort of immigration concern. And that isn't quite as clear cut with this current administration. We did do a training a couple months ago to help people sort of be prepared if someone from ICE came in the doors, kind of what do we do and how do we respond to that to hopefully keep all of our staff and patients safe and feeling like we are a safe space where you can come and access medical care. We, as is mandated as a federally qualified health center, do not turn anyone away who is seeking medical care. Everybody is welcome to come in and get the care that they need, and we will do our best to link people to services in the community to help them live their best life. And so if you are an immigrant, you are still welcome to receive medical care and behavioral health care and dental care, use our pharmacy and receive vaccines. We want to care for our whole community in a very safe and equitable way.
That is so good to hear. And we hope that you can keep those precautions in place. And we hear that other places have not been so fortunate. And let's hope that we can maintain for Montana.
I read recently that there's a mosquito-borne illness that's becoming more prevalent. I'm forgetting the name of it. Can you help me out here? Not malaria, but something else.
Is it the
encephalitis?
I don't know how you pronounce it.
Go ahead. Say it again.
Chikungunya?
Yes, yes. That was it. And do you know much about it? Is it I know mosquitoes aren't as bad here as they are in the South, but they are here.
I did hear about a great big outbreak that's happening in China in a region that has not seen this disease in the past. And so there is concern, whereas this has always been a disease sort of in warmer climates, way more prevalent in Africa and South America and I think southern parts of Asia. The fact that it's moving, you know, much like we saw with Zika in the past, speaks to our changing climate and how vectors of disease are also changing their habitats. I did hear about some research ongoing in Montana, sort of looking out for ticks. And unfortunately, we've found some deer ticks in Montana, which in general are the host for Lyme disease, which we've never felt is endemic to this area. They have not found deer ticks infected with Lyme, but I think the scope of disease is changing as our climate is changing, and vectors for disease are maybe changing their habitat as well.
Thank you for that vital information. And we hope that maybe we can develop a vaccine for each of those that is very effective. And just can't thank you and Kyle enough for being with us and helping us to understand the medical scene better.
Before we sign off, any final comments?
Well, we hope that everybody gathered some good information from this talk, and maybe we intrigued some people to think about healthcare as a career change or a career choice.
I guess, Cal, you would agree.
Absolutely.
You hang in there, Kyle. We'll all want to have you back on once you're a practicing physician, maybe once while you're in medical school, telling us about the extreme pain and suffering you are enduring.
I'm looking forward to that time then.
So as we close the program, Health and Happiness, presented at 7 o'clock on Monday evenings and 9 o'clock on Thursday mornings on KGVM 95.9 or KGVM.org. We thank our participants today with their expertise. We hope the Gallatin Valley stays healthy and happy and continues to visit appropriate medical personnel to keep your health well and continue to listen to this and other programs on KGVM. We'll see you next time. Thank you.